Good evening. You're listening to The Forum on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Tonight, instead of the regular All Souls Forum, we bring you a special talk given at All Souls Church on the night of March 9th. The talk was presented by American Promise, a national group of which Kansas City is a local chapter. Tonight, we're going to hear two author activists, Jeff Clements, author of Corporations Are Not People, and Derek Cressman, author of When Money Talks. The very first voice you will hear will be that of Mike Dean, organizer for American Promise, Kansas City region.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Mike. Hello, everyone. Hello, Winston Apple. If I can get your attention, then I'll get everybody else's attention.
It's now officially undivided.
All right. Thank you. Hi, everyone. There was a poll taken last year, and 94% of Americans said that our political system, the American political system, is just messed up. And that same poll showed that 90% of Americans think there is nothing that we can do about it. So you must be part of the 4% that believe that we can do something about this. My name is Mike Dean. I'm with American Promise, Kansas City region. And we're one of the few associations of this brand new national organization that has just launched in a few select cities. Now, some of you may remember Kansas City Move to Amend, and the core group of Kansas City Move to Amend essentially voted to join American Promise. And first of all, let me get that group up. And we have Mary Lindsay here. Please stand up so everyone knows who you are. Jennifer Smith. We have Dave Mitchell, Mike Nichols, Tom Huffman, of course. Winston Apple has been with us. John Bloom has been with us. Louise Lloyd is a new member of our group now.
Lou Ross.
Lou Ross is a veteran. And Sarah, what's your last name again?
Hazen.
Sarah, pleased to see you as well.
John Dean.
And of course, John Dean. Thank you.
And Stacy.
Stacy, oh, Stacy. Hey, Stacy. Stacy, what? So thank you, everybody. Well, that's not true. Somebody had to say that, okay. Winston. But we decided as a group to join American Promise because it has a commitment to cross-partisanship. And passing an amendment is going to take a lot of people. 80% of Americans believe that there's way, way too much money in politics and it's corrupting our political system. And that's 80% of Democrats, it's 80% of Republicans. I mean, but forget about that distinction anymore. Because, I mean, you can see what is happening in the primary elections. The real distinction nowadays is between the economic and political establishment elites and the vast majority of American citizens, the base. And plutocrats and billionaires think that they can find it so easy to divide us, and usually they try to do so along social issues, and they try to slot us into Republican or Democrat and really blunt whatever power we should have as a unified group. Well, American Promise has three principles, and that's all we ask is that you sign up for those three principles. And Jeff is going to talk about that. But let's honor each other regardless of some of the other things that are very important. Some of those issues are very important, but they're cultural issues and they divide us as to the real important base issue of economic money in politics and just the corporate power that's really taking over our political process.
Amen.
Thank you. Now, a lot of people say that it is way too hard to pass an amendment, and it is hard. But the Supreme Court has been wrong about a number of things in the past, and the American people have passed an amendment to overrule the Supreme Court. They have said in the past that African Americans don't have equal rights. They have said that women don't have the right to vote. They have said that 18, 19, 20-year-old young men, they don't have the right to vote, but they can sure go off to war. Well, each time the American people overruled the Supreme Court decision, in fact, I believe it's happened 7 times where the Supreme Court has come up with something, some cockamamie rule, and the American people have passed an amendment. Now, huge transnational organizations and their billionaire owners, their multimillionaire CEOs, they invest in paid speech because it's a very, very lucrative return on their investment. And if cities or states want to pass a law that, say, encourages the use of solar power, or that helps protect unions, or that raises the minimum wage, you'll find some corporation will quickly file a lawsuit saying that their equal rights under the Constitution are under attack. And they have teams of hundreds of lawyers, yes, and that's a big part of their power. But the real central part of their legal power derives from the fact of this flawed concept of corporate personhood. And their source of political power is from the fact that paid political speech is a protected First Amendment right of billionaires. If we're going to restore the balance between corporations and citizens, we need to remove these illegitimate rights from their playbook. If you care about global warming, if you care about wealth inequality, if you care about cleaning up our government, the solution starts here. You should join American Promise. And tonight we have two leading experts on these intertwined topics. I'm going to mention that Jeff Clements is here. He's a Cornell law grad. He's a constitutional lawyer, author of Corporations Are Not People. Yes. So we're going to start it off with Derek Pressman. He was the director of Common Causes 2012 Amend 2012 campaign. He's done a lot of work for the Public Interest Research Group. He's testified before U.S. Senate committees. He's the author of When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech. And Derek, take it away now. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thanks to American Promise for bringing us together tonight. I want to talk a little bit about a different way of thinking about the problem of money in politics, and then suggest one or two they may feel like new ideas for going about tackling it, although actually some of them are hundreds of years old. But let me first start by thanking you all for coming here tonight. And I say that not only to be polite, although my mother taught me I should always be polite. And I am, you know, after doing this work for about 20 years, I am genuinely moved by the fact that so many people care about it and are willing to devote a part of their day to learning more about these issues. And I realize that that's a big deal because our time is incredibly scarce, at least most of us, right? You know. We have jobs where there's more work to do than you can fit into an eight-hour day. We often have a family we need to take care of. We have chores we need to do. Our email inboxes are overflowing. Remember when it was exciting? You've got mail. And now it's like, oh, gosh, yeah. I've got 200 emails, right? And, you know, amidst all of that, we still need to find time to not only to vote, but to learn about how to vote and to follow public affairs. And You know, I estimate it at best a conscientious citizen maybe has an average of an hour a day to either read the newspaper or, you know, follow evening news or go to a talk like this, you know, but it's a finite amount of time. And if you think about what we do in other settings where we have a finite amount of time, we very strictly limit the amount that each person talks so that everybody has a chance to be heard, right? So you go to most city council meetings and there's a public comment period where pretty much anyone in the town can stand up and say whatever they want, and I've seen all sorts of crazy things said, but you know, usually for 2 minutes, or I was in Lincoln last night, they said it was 3 minutes there. Los Angeles, it's one. It kind of depends on how many people show up, but everybody's speech is limited. And we do the same thing on the floors of Congress. You watch C-SPAN, you'll see they spend half their time arguing about, you know, how much time do I have left, and I yield 3 minutes to the gentleman from Virginia, and so on and so forth, and then when your time's up, the gavel comes down, and that's it, and they vote. Even the U.S. Supreme Court does this. When there's oral arguments, they limit each side's lawyers. Usually it's 30 minutes, sometimes it's only 15. And they also limit the length of pages in briefs that you could submit ahead of time. And there's a funny story in the book about what happened to BP Oil when they tried to cheat on their page limits by using a smaller font size. Because right? It's not the page length, it's the amount of information. And the judges want to feel like they are hearing from both sides so they can issue a fair ruling and a wise ruling. And it seems so obvious, you know, it's like, why would anyone write a book about that, right? We all learned in kindergarten that more or less you sit down, you raise your hand, you talk one at a time, and the teacher will silence everyone else so that you can be heard when you're talking. Now, as obvious as it seems, I feel like many of the members of our Supreme Court must have never gone to kindergarten, because this is what they tell us. And this came not 6 years ago in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which was a terrible ruling. But 40 years ago, when the court looked at the post-Watergate laws that were passed by Congress, I think it's important to remember that in our lifetime, Congress did pass very tough campaign finance laws. So we can make them act. And they passed laws along those lines of city council meetings, saying each candidate's going to spend the same amount. And so you'll hear from each candidate with a mandatory spending limit. They said we'll put limits on how much a billionaire can spend on their own campaign or how much they can give to an outside campaign. And the court initially upheld that limit on how much they can give to an outside campaign, but they struck down the even spending limits and the limits on personal wealth. And so long before Citizens United, we had a pretty unworkable campaign finance system where some voices were heard much louder than others. And then after Citizens United, we got the super PACs where it's really gone crazy. But the core problem goes back to here. And I've read the First Amendment, and it actually doesn't say that, right? Anyone notice that? The word money isn't in there either. But imagine for a minute what a city council meeting would look like if we believed the Supreme Court, that we could not silence any one voice so that other people could be heard, right? So if you went down to the Kansas City City Council meeting and you stood up and gave your 2 minutes of public comment, and then the next guy stands up and says, you know, I've got $10,000 right here. I'd like to buy an hour's worth of time. And, you know, I'm a very important person in town. I employ a lot of people. I'm going to talk for an hour. Now, nobody would think that the First Amendment required us to let him do that, right? And if the parliamentarian of the meeting said, oh, that's fine, as long as you take the bag off your head and disclose who you are, you can buy an hour's worth of time. Our initial response would be to fire the parliamentarian, right? Because the meeting soon becomes unworkable and unusable. I think most people would stand up and leave. And I think that's what a lot of voters are doing right now, when they are realizing their voice is not heard near as much as the millionaires and billionaires. Well, what's the point of me participating in this process? Now, problem is we do need them to participate, so we'll talk about how to overcome that in a minute. But that's the absurdity that we're in. Now, people would push back on me and go, well, Okay, Derek, yeah. Of course we have limits on speech when there's a roof over your head. You know, the city council's got a lot of issues to discuss. There are thousands of bills for Congress to debate, all these decisions for courts. So because of those limits, we have to limit the time of each speaker. And yet, if you think about it, that's why I started off the conversation by pointing out that you too, as voters, have limited time. And if all of that time is consumed by people with billionaires, or you know, billionaire speech, it's less time for you to hear other people. And it turns out we have limits on speech outside the building all over the place. Now, that's a picture of a 99 Rise protester who was arrested for speaking too much outside of a building. And there's a story of when I was participating in the 99 Rise outside of the state capitol in Sacramento, and about 10:30 at night, we were told by the Capitol Police that our permit had expired to speak, as if there's an expiration date in the First Amendment, and we'd spoken too much, and they hauled us off to jail for speaking too much. I think that situation went too far, but you know, there are other situations. If you think about the Occupy protests in Zuccotti Park, or the, I don't know what you call Ayman Bundy's movement, but those folks who were speaking for a very long time at a public space in Oregon, in both cases, after a couple of weeks, the police said, you know, you've made your point, we've heard you, there's other people who would like to use this public space as a park or for bird watching without fear of getting shot by your guns, so we're going to limit your speech. And I think most people agreed with those concepts, and certainly if we're going to limit political speech so that other people can enjoy silence, certainly we would limit it so that other people's voices could be heard. My favorite example is when I started my book tour a little over a month ago, I went to Portland and stayed at Tom's house. That's him there, his house. And can't quite read it, but across the top of his porch, he put up a sign that said, "End Corporate Rule." He thought this was pretty cool. His neighbors thought this was pretty cool. Until about a week later, he gets this pink slip in the mail from the city of Portland saying, "We're going to start fining you $50 a day for violating Portland's sign ordinance. Your sign is too big. You are speaking too much. So we are going to limit your speech. It needs to be 2 feet by 3 feet. Same size as all the realtor signs, and actually most political lawn signs are that size for that reason, because it turns out most towns have ordinances like this that limit the volume or the size of your political speech on your own property. And it seems a bit offensive. You know, I actually think we have gone too far towards limiting real people's really free speech. And then there's a bonus chapter to the book that you can download at the website that I'll pop up at the end, is whenmoneytalks.com, talking about how we've gone too far regulating free speech. But even I would concede, you know, I don't think I would want everybody on my block to have a neon billboard, you know, 20 feet by 30 feet talking about, you know, vote Trump, vote Bernie, whatever it is. And it's because at a certain point, it becomes visual clutter, and we become inundated with all this information, which is actually stressful. And you tend to just start tuning everything out, right? And this is a real conundrum that we face for self-government in the modern era, where there is far more information out there than any one of us could possibly consume. Now, the average New York Times today has as much information in it in one day's edition as a person in Thomas Jefferson's era encountered their entire lifetime. Wow. So, you know, hundreds of cable TV channels, millions of internet sites, right? And as an information guru, Clay Shirky, he says, it's not that there's too much information, it's that our filters fail, right? Imagine what your life's like when your spam filter doesn't work, right? So the question is then, if there's more information than you can consume and you need to filter some of it out, who decides, right? And I think we can all agree we don't want government to be the one deciding what information to filter out. That's censorship, and we're rightly fearful of that. But I think we also don't want advertisers to be the one making that choice. And if you think about it, by design, advertising is intended to puncture your information filters and put information in front of you that you weren't seeking out in the first place. And there's a critical distinction that allows you to be the one in control of your own information filters, which I think is what is necessary for self-government to work. And we need to think about two different kinds of speech. One that I'll call free speech, meaning free in that you can speak your conscience without being arrested, but also free in that it's free to the speaker. So if you write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper, they don't charge you. If you call in to a local radio program, they don't charge you. When I write a book, the publisher doesn't charge me. They pay me. And that's because in those cases, the listener is paying the costs of the speech. On the flip side of that is when the speaker is paying the costs of the speech through paid advertisements. And I think what we need to be very careful of in a democracy is to make sure that paid speech does not overwhelm free speech, basically by tuning people out to the entire political process because the information filters they set up. And that, to me, is the justification for putting limits on paid speech, which is a different way of thinking about this problem than bribery or corruption. It's, you know, how do we make wise decisions as a community? And there's whole big chapters in the book that I'm going to skip over now. I'm going to limit my speech because there's some other important speech that we want to hear about in a sec. But so, Supreme Court does not see it this way. So what do we do? One thing I write about in the book that seemed very distant at the time was we could wait for a new court. And then, wouldn't you know, 3 weeks later, we have a new court, 4-4. And you know, there's debate within the reform community about, well, maybe we should just let the new court take care of it and don't go through the artisan process of a constitutional amendment. And as a reformer, I would love to win that easy way. But we've already seen it's far from guaranteed, right? Evidently, President Obama's interviewing 5 people, including one judge, I believe, here from Missouri. And I certainly don't know how any of them stand on Citizens United. Some of the names I've seen floated I know are actually bad on Citizens United. So it's far from guaranteed, no matter who's president and who controls the Congress, that we will get a fifth justice who would see things the way I'm describing on this issue. But even if we did, I think it's quite likely we would see a partial repeal of Citizens United. You know, maybe they take us back to 2010 on money and politics, but don't overturn the doctrine of corporate personhood, and don't take us back to 1976 on Buckley. Or even if they do that, maybe we get a wonderful victory, but then in 10 years, 15 years, the composition of the court changes again, and we could find our First Amendment, our foundational document, flipping back and forth every 15, 20 years based on the whimsy of who has a stroke or a heart attack on whose watch. And I just don't think that is a serious way to treat our Constitution or to treat self-government. So waiting for a new court feels a bit to me like, you know, if the colonists had just decided to wait for a new king. King George was lousy, maybe the next guy will be better. And he might have been. But I think it's important, even if we get a new court, and even if we get a good ruling, to have a national conversation and permanently cement these principles of self-government into our Constitution. The other thing about winning through the court is it wouldn't necessarily create the political will that we would need to actually pass a law in Congress. I mean, right now, let's remember, we can't even pass disclosure of money in politics, even though the court would uphold that. We can't pass public financing of campaigns, even though the court would uphold that. So even if the court said, okay, you can go back and pass the McCain-Feingold law again, and you can pass the post-Watergate law again, we wouldn't necessarily have a Congress that would be willing to do that. So I think the amendment organizing not only gets us the amendment, it does what we need to do to get the law. So it's difficult to do, right? And we've already talked a little bit about the process of how to do that, so I don't want to belabor that, but I will say I agree with what Mike said in that I am not willing to concede that it is too hard. And in fact, if we actually believe that, if we believe that 80% of the country can no longer amend our Constitution, I think we have a far bigger problem than money in politics. I think that means we have lost the republic that our framers gave us. I don't think we have, but that's why I am doing what I'm doing and pushing for an amendment. So there's a tool that I talk a lot about in the book that may be unfamiliar that I'll just raise now, and then, you know, we can talk more about it later if you're interested. But There's a practice going back to the founding period where people would elect someone to represent them to the Continental Congress and give them very specific marching orders on a few issues on how they wanted to be represented. On most of them, they'd say, hey, we trust you, go do what you want to do. And in fact, the framers in Philadelphia, many of them were under specific instructions as to how the Constitution could look. And when those framers, like John Dickinson, went out and ratified the Constitution or made the pitch, he's like, hey, you're going to be able to amend this. We know it's not perfect. And you can do it through a process of instruction, or he called it enjoining your elected officials, seeing how you want to do that. And the 11th Amendment actually came about very quickly to overturn a Supreme Court ruling that the states hated. And they instructed their members of the Senate to pass the 11th Amendment to the Constitution to overturn that. And we've used that throughout our history, including most notably to pass the 17th Amendment to win direct election of US senators, where we had a similar problem of incumbents not wanting to change the process that they got elected by. So I've been working with others to try to revive this tactic, worked with Free Speech for People and Jeff to take this idea to Montana in 2012. Where, you know, a pretty conservative state, 64% of the state voted for Mitt Romney, but 75% of Montanans voted to instruct their member of Congress to pass an amendment to overturn Citizens United. Similar results in Colorado. I'm excited to say folks in Washington state just turned in signatures to place an instruction measure on their ballot there, and we're on the verge of getting one on the ballot statewide in California. Something you can also do at the local level in many, many cities. And so I'd encourage you all to be exploring opportunities for doing this either locally or statewide in Missouri or Kansas. And there's more details on that in the book, and I'd be happy to talk more, but it's a different tactic. And then let me just wrap up and say, you know, I don't believe that's the only tactic or the only silver bullet. And I'm not one of those folks who say, you know, the reform that I talk about in the book is the silver bullet that'll fix everything. I think we need to deal with money as speech. We need to deal with corporate personhood. We also need to deal with redistricting and voting rights and a whole slew of other things. And I think these things all add to each other rather than compete with one another, which is how it feels sometimes as an activist with different groups kind of making their pitch of like, this is the most important thing you could be doing. I think it's all important. And you know, I never let anyone tell me it's impossible. You know, in my lifetime, we've seen apartheid fall in South Africa. We saw the Berlin Wall fall in the Soviet Union. 100 years ago, we saw a wave of reforms in this country, ranging from women's suffrage to banning corporate money in federal politics, to the initiative process, to direct election of senators. I think we are on the cusp of a similar wave of reform in this country, but only when we make it happen. And so I'm excited that folks are coming together to talk about that all around the country. And with that thought, let me hand it off to my good friend Jeff to both talk about his book and this idea of American promise and how folks are banding together to do this kind of work. And then we'll throw it up for questions after that.
We've been listening to Derek Cressman, author of When Money Talks. This is a special forum, not part of the regular All Souls Forum series, but recorded at All Souls Church nonetheless on March 9th. This forum was presented by American Promise. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear from Jeff Clement, author of Corporations Are Not People. Jeff Clement, author of Corporations Are Not People.
Thank you, Derek. If I could change the PowerPoint, Mary. So while Mary's doing that, let me just thank Derek for being here, for his book, for his great work around the country. You know, he's been in this fight longer than there's been Citizens United. If you wanted to know about the amendment idea to take on money in politics, you could have talked to Derek Cressman in the 1990s. And he was a visionary before his time. He saw where it was headed. He was calling the alarm for the country. And the country's got the word now. And I think we're going to get that amendment. And he'll deserve more credit than just about anybody. So thank you, Derek. And his book is really good. But Derek's book's a great narrative, as he laid out tonight. It helps us make the arguments when people tell you, like, oh, you know, if we limit money in politics, somehow that violates free speech. Well, no, somehow that begins to look like a democracy where everybody gets a chance to be an equal citizen in our government. So it's a really important book. What I want to do briefly, because I want to thank Mike Dean, too, for that great opening. I joked with him, he stole all my lines. I don't have anything left to say. Because he really laid out what we're here for. That we're basically at a crossroads, plutocracy or democracy. And we have a choice, but it's going to be a big fight. But we are seriously talking not about public policy, campaign, finance, wonky choices, or we are talking fundamentally about, and as Derek said too, about whether we're a republic or not. Those are the stakes. And so, An American Promise, I'll talk a bit about the book, but I also want to talk about American Promise because I know a lot of you are familiar with the problem. You've been working on this problem too. And it's really about how we accelerate now the change the country wants to see, right? I think we see it. Americans know the current system is broken and they're willing to try almost anything as long as it's not the current system. And that can be dangerous when people are, let's roll through this quickly, if I can figure out which way this goes. There we go. So here's what I'll do tonight. American Promise is all about wide inclusion. It's about bringing us back together as Americans around our fundamental core beliefs. And I believe these core beliefs are shared by virtually every American, that we have constitutional rights because of our humanity, right? And it goes right back to the founding that, you know, we take these truths as being self-evident, that all are created equal, that we're created equal, we start equal, but we don't end up unequal in the political sphere. Economic, material, you know, inequalities will always be a challenge and a problem. But one place where we have always said as a country, we have rights because we're human beings is in our Constitution, and we're equal citizens, it's the second one, related. We're equal citizens in the political sphere. One person, one vote. Right? One, equal representation. We're supposed to have an equal voice in our political sphere. Those are core beliefs. And if we can bring back, we can organize around those core beliefs rather than saying, are you for this amendment or that amendment? Are you Republican? Are you Democrat? Are you, you know, you want disclosure and, you know, public funding, not constitutional amendments? There's plenty of time for all kinds of good debate, but if we stick together around our core beliefs, that's when we really take off and begin to channel the 80 or 90% that's swirling now around good ideas, crazy ideas, anything but the current system. We begin to organize it and move forward as a country for a much better future. So the third one, though, is the challenge, right? That says, and this is, again, I think core American beliefs, we're equal, we have rights because we're human, but you can't take it for granted. In the end, we have them because we govern ourselves. We have each have a responsibility, an equal responsibility in our self-government, and we govern together. That means we don't all agree necessarily, but we commit to a democracy, we commit to a republic, a process of governing together. Even sometimes when we don't even like each other, we have to govern together. But sometimes we find if we govern together, we actually like each other more. So anyway, those are our core beliefs that we organize around. So why does this matter? Sort of like what Derek said, well, we learned that in kindergarten. Well, we don't live that way anymore. We don't live with our core beliefs in this country anymore, as Derek said, as Mike said, as you know. And it's not just us saying this, and it's not just like a vague feeling. People like Jim Leach, Republican from Iowa, you know, hardly a radical, saying that Citizens United has genetically altered our democratic DNA in this country, pushing us towards corporatist oligarchy. That is a description that I think is accurate, but it's not one you would have expected a Republican, former Republican congressman to say. So we have a choice, and I'll move through quickly. Why? Democracy or oligarchy? This might be generous to say we are here rather than we're down the road a little bit. We got to get back and get back on the right road. But we have a choice. And so, pointing that the wrong way. I'll just move quickly through this. We know the problem. $30 billion since Citizens United in elections. almost all of it coming from far less than 1% of the population. 400 families accounting for more than half the money in the presidential race so far. And those are the responses. I don't mind you being rich. I mind you buying my government. Corporate money's pouring in. Don't let anyone tell you, oh, it's really just billionaires, although that's certainly bad enough. Global corporations don't like to be seen spending the money in political races. They funnel it through Republican Governors Association, Democratic Governors Association, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, lots of other fronts. This is just the three I mentioned. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, RGA, DGA, as they call them, Governors Associations, that are really just lobby fests. They're not governors' associations, like the governors are pitching in $50 a piece to have, a campaign. It's meet and greet and party on with corporate lobbyists who funnel millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into our state, local, federal elections through these front groups. Some unions too, they're up there too. Unions are concentrated money as well. Different category, different issues, but the law struck down by Citizens United applied to unions and corporations, and so that money's running through too. These are the impacts. We can all tell our stories. I hope we will. I don't need to tell your story. We all know the impacts are in also every aspect of our life, from our wages to the water we drink, to our schools, to our food system. You name it, it's impacted by this in a bad way. And the kids in the middle are what it's all about. If we do our job, we will pass on a democracy worthy of the name, and I think we will do our job. This amendment, we will win, I think, in the next decade. But the fight is really about what those kids are going to live under and whether we are going to be the generation that passes on an oligarchy rather than a democracy. I don't think so, and like Derek and you, I'm determined to not let it happen. So, some people are not yet able to find, where do I go? I'm despairing, I'm hopeless. And those are justifiable feelings, right? I mean, we're powerless, we're pushed out, we don't have a voice, our jobs, you name it. It's been a tough decade or so, and we're starting to see it unravel a little bit. And there's two things that are part of the problem that we have to recognize, that it's not just out there as, oh, big money, or out there as corporations, although those are both very true. It's actually in here, too, in all of us, about whether we will do what this fellow's doing. He didn't actually say that. I've juxtaposed some things. I took that quote that says, I just want to watch the establishment burn, from a Donald Trump supporter in Texas who said he was a conservative. And he said, nationalism is the new thing, man. Conservatism is a failed ideology. I just want to sit back and watch the establishment burn. Those were his reasons for supporting Donald Trump. Now, I'm not criticizing that. You can decide what you think. But that's his reaction. He's recognizing, he was lied to. He was told, oh, be a conservative. Our wages will go up. We'll have more freedom. We'll have all the things. And you could say on the same thing on the left. We've been lied to about, if we only just went with this ideology, everything would be fine. And so he's ready to sit back and watch the establishment burn. And there's some of that phenomenon. It's not unusual that that's what happens when we lose any society, but especially a society built on our equal rights, begins to drift or be severed from our core beliefs. You look for extreme solutions. The other thing that happens, though, is this, is people stay home. They give up, they do something else besides politics. It's too horrifying. They do something else besides the hard work of meeting with neighbors like you're doing tonight, meeting in your community, for doing the things that American Promise Associations are asking us to do, which is to volunteer some of your hard time, limited time, for a lot of hard work for our country. And it's hard, and we see things like this. Boston, where I'm from, November elections, we had contested city council elections, hotly contested, incumbent challenged, as incumbents are being challenged more and more, thankfully, but only 13% turnout, 87% stayed home. midterms nationally in 2014 was about 33%, which means 2 out of 3 voters aren't feeling like it's worth doing. So that's part of the problem. I won't spend time on this. I agree with Derek. I'll leave it at that. This is like, oh, but wait, it's all going to be solved by a new court. And I will only add one other note to Derek's critique of the notion that we'll just get a new justice and we don't have to do this hard work. And that's this. If you were a woman or any, you know, American who thought equality meant everybody gets to vote in 1875, and the Supreme Court told you you weren't allowed to vote, a lot of people started organizing. The suffrage movement happened. It became an amendment or court kind of change. If you went with the court strategy, you would have been disappointed. 25 Supreme Court justices died or retired in the time that we started working for the 19th Amendment to get women the right to vote, and we finally won the 19th Amendment. The Supreme Court never came close to saying, oh, maybe we were wrong, you know? And the same thing happened with the poll tax. Supreme Court twice said, oh, it's perfectly fine to have a poll tax. So if you can't afford to participate in your elections, too bad. If you can't, you know, if you can't pay your tax, including all your back taxes that you couldn't pay before, you're not allowed to vote. Too bad. Supreme Court said nothing wrong with that. And millions of Americans were deprived of the right to vote for decades. If you said, well, the Supreme Court, although it's the Warren Court, they're going to change it, right? They're going to overturn that. You would have been waiting. 18 justices came and went in the years that Americans fought for the amendment that ended poll taxes. I could go on. Those 7 amendments that overturned the Supreme Court, that's almost always what we've had to do. The Brown versus Board of Education, those kind of iconic Supreme Court decisions are the exception, not the rule. So, full speed ahead. The 28th Amendment is coming, and we have to do it, and it's going to do this. It might be the 28th, 29th. The thing about American promise is we're going to have that debate about with each other, what the amendment should say, all of that. I'm not here to tell you it's going to say this, it's going to say that. There are good amendments out there. One of them got 54 votes in the Senate in November 2014. This is moving. There's others. You could criticize that one, say it didn't go far enough on corporations. That's fine. The We the People Amendment is up in our resources section. I'll talk about soon, too. And I'll talk about our strategy, about why it's okay to not have the one imperfect amendment today, right now, even though we have lots of good ones that you are free to back and support and move forward. But what we seek is putting our core beliefs that I opened with back into the Constitution, reset our foundation back to equal people, human beings governing ourselves, and then a lot of the other reforms will come if we get that right. So we're building on strength. You know, you've been in this. You know, American promise is not like, oh, let's do an amendment out of the blue like it's our idea. We are building on strength. We are inclusive for all the groups, and lots of, more importantly, the millions of Americans who have not yet been part of this are now able to come in and have this conversation. But we're building on the strength of the resolutions that Derek talked about, the resolutions you know about. We're building on the strength of the polls, which over and over again show agreement. But we need more. We need much more local. We need much more cross-partisanship. We need much more sustained citizen action and connection with each other. 700 resolutions across the country have called for amendment, the 28th Amendment. But we're not connected to each other, so we're not able to build on that energy. So that's what American Promise does. These are the basic components of it, and I'll just quickly move through some of them. This is a barn raising that we just had in Concord, Massachusetts, where I'm from. 80 people put up. That's the morning break. It went up another story or two with almost no tools. A guy with a sledgehammer, it's post and beam, and it got finished that day, and it was a beautiful thing to see, and everyone did a little bit of work, and I'm emphasizing this because this, our principle at American Promise is like a barn raising. It's local, it's fun, it builds community, and you don't have to, you know, drop everything, leave your job, hurt your health, you know, destroy yourself to win. You just have to show up take your piece of the beam and help lift it into place, and we will build our 28th Amendment and rebuild our republic. So I'd like to keep this image in mind. It's local, it's together, it's strong. Nobody asked which party you're in at this, I guarantee you. They said, do you want to help build a barn? So that's, we're building the 28th Amendment barn together. We're not going to be like the post and beam purists who said, I won't use electric power tools, I won't use... We're using technology, and we're going to use it smartly, and it's going to connect us together. This is AP Connect. If some of you I know, American Promise members, will you raise your hands? Just, yeah, thank you, number one. The pioneers, the early adopters, thank you so much. And I hope the rest of you will join. I'll ask you to join soon. But those of you who've joined already know that you get access to this member platform, really. It does two things. I was going to say network, but it is a network. It connects you here in Kansas City, in your region, and then it connects you nationally to other American Promise associations locally. So you can learn from each other, share information, share the best ideas, share the setbacks, share the challenges, and people will have experience to share with you, and we learn from each other. But it's also resources. You want to know about all those amendments? They're on there. You want to debate about constitutional convention? Good idea or not? You know, we're not going to say what the answer to that is. It's on there, and there's a lot of good members of American Promise who have ideas about that, and will be happy to engage in conversation about that. It's how we learn. It's how we get stronger. There's a ton of other stuff, which I'll be happy to talk about as we go on. We have 8 American Promise associations. You are leaders here. Kansas City, Little Rock, yay. Here's to you. And you're showing the way. So we have Kansas City, Little Rock, Arkansas, Ypsilanti, Michigan, Portland, Maine, San Francisco. I'm doing one. I'm a volunteer in everything, like just like you. But I'm also a volunteer like Mike and some of you who stepped up to try to help keep it moving. We call them captains. We're not leaders. We're captains in the sense like a sports team captain, just another player, but someone who tries to help hold it together and keep it moving. So we like co-captains too. I'm sure Mike would welcome the help, and we'll have some co-captains.
Well, I know. We've got co-captains all of the name.
Yeah.
We can always use more co-captains.
Thank you to all the co-captains and everybody who pitches in, because that's what it's about. So, but I got on that because I'm doing it in my town, my community, Concord, Massachusetts, and the 6 towns around it are a local. We call it the North Bridge American Promise Association. North Bridge is the bridge in Concord over the Concord River, where April 19th, 1775, Americans finally, we didn't call them us Americans then, I guess we were English subjects at the time, and stood up to the British and said no further. And they were sent packing back to Boston. That North Bridge, the Minutemen came from all the towns that are in our APA, and so they didn't like us calling it Concord APA anyway. So it's the North Bridge APA, but it also is symbolic of, all right, it's an emergency, it's about our fundamental rights, come together, stand up. So we have 8 of them. This is what we're going to look like, I hope, by the end of the year, certainly into 2017. And then that purple is like our logo. It's the blue and the red, and it's coming together to move forward. We're going to light up the map, and we're going to light up our states. We're going to light up our communities with this fire of our core beliefs as Americans and drive the 28th Amendment. We have, when I say national, the action and the work and the whole core of this is really at the local level. The national, we exist only to serve you. If we're not serving the local APAs, and that's why I'm doing one of the APAs too, so I know what it's like to try to do it and try to make sure you're getting the right support, then there's no reason for us to exist. We exist to do that. But one of the things we did was to say, hey, let's get some national leadership, not to tell you what to do or anything, to model standing up for beliefs across partisan lines. So all of these people, it's hard to read here, but I can translate it. You can t- take a closer look. All of those quotes are specifically supporting the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution to overturn Citizens United. We have Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian and president, Pulitzer Prize winning author, Alan Simpson, Republican senator from Wyoming, Mike Dukakis, as you know, a Massachusetts Democrat, ran for president, Reverend Catherine Henderson, who runs Auburn Seminary. The idea is different walks of life, not just political. This isn't just politics. It's all of our lives. So it's, we have faith leaders like Reverend Henderson. We have business leaders like Donald Baird, an entrepreneur in New York City. He's a wonderful guy. Jim Leach, who we saw at the start of this. Judy Wicks, Matt Patsky, Bob Monks, all business leaders in various places. Jim Nelson, who I'll wrap up with his story. That Montana fight that we had, Jim Nelson was a Montana Supreme Court justice appointed by Republican governor of Montana, Vietnam vet. He was on the court when the Montana law that had stood for 100 years got challenged after Citizens United by a corporate front group, money front group. And Free Speech for People filed a brief, tried to help defend the law. We actually won in the Montana Supreme Court. The Montana Supreme Court said Citizens United couldn't possibly mean that the First Amendment has been so changed since we had a law in 1912 that now we're no longer allowed to keep corporate money out of our elections. Montana was owned essentially by the copper mining industry in the turn of the century. They stood up and they fought back and got that law. And Jim Nelson was on the court at the time. It went on from there to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, based on Citizens United, overturned the Montana Supreme Court. Basically gave them the back of the hand. All the state laws, all the local laws that limit corporate or union money, gone. Jim Nelson retired from the court and joined our board at Free Speech for People, the board of directors, and joined our advisory committees committed to winning this 28th Amendment. So that helps, I think, at the local level to say, look, if these people, Republicans, Democrats, different walks of life, can stand up for this, we can too. Let's come together and do it. We can go into details on this. We have a strategic plan to win the 28th Amendment. Happy to share the details on that. But basically, I'll say this. We look to Congress in about 4 years. It's not about getting the two-thirds of Congress that we'll need to vote on this amendment now. This can change. I mean, the 2016 election outcome might change the strategy. But when we did this, the thinking was the 2020 election is the one that brings in the historic reform Congress that we're going to help make if we do our work, if we do these two steps. This is like cut it into steps that we can manage. And if we build the first part of building out APAs all over the country, building out our infrastructure, coming together in this new kind of way that we're seeing, where basically it's not Republican Democrat, it's not, you know, social issue against social issue, it's corporatist and, you know, big money against almost everybody else. That's how we'll win that. And so there's some things you can do. I know some of you are already in America Promise. Thank you. You join your local association. It is a dues structure, I should mention. It's and that helps sustain this. Looking at all the things that were missing pieces in the amendment movement, even though we've come so far, the missing pieces were many of the local things I talked about, a lot of the things I talked about. But the other one is sustaining funding for this for the 10 years that it will take. It might go faster. I hope it will. But we need to be prepared for a 10-year battle, 38-state ratification fight. We need to be ready to win against heavily funded opposition at times. And so the way we do that isn't going to be anymore going to foundations and wealthy people and saying, please give us grants so we can do this. It's going to be we're going to do it ourselves. So I'm a member too, just like everyone else. And we pay monthly dues or annual dues, whatever you want. But we have a range, like we want our democracy to be. We have a maximum. We have a minimum too, but that membership pays for the infrastructure. It pays for building this out, because remember, we want those gold purple stars to be all over this country. And we want Kansas City to fill the library when Derek's here in in July back again, and that's going to take the money. So so it does, it do join. It, you own it, we own it together, we can build it, and it will scale up fast, and we can win this. And then there's some other things you can do. Pencil in your calendars, the American Promise National Convention, September 29th, September 30th, October 2nd. It's in Washington, D.C. It's going to be great. We're going to keep growing this. We're going to have a few hundred people there together, and it'll be where we actually all come together, not just on the AP Connect, but in real time. And it's also a celebration. You know, Ben Cohen's going to be there with his stamper machine, and we're going to have a big band. I don't know if any of you know Donna the Buffalo, but they're going to be, it's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of good substance too, and a lot of good learning and a lot of good energy to come out and do this work around the country. So there's things you can do. But tonight, in addition to joining, you can buy a book and talk to Derek. The books are there, two books, and we'll have conversation as well. So thank you for your attention and patience, and thank you, Derek, and thank you to all of you.
You've been listening to a special forum recorded at All Souls Church on the evening of March 9th. The speakers were Derek Cressman and Jeff Clement. This forum was put together by American Promise, Kansas City Region. You are tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, coming up at 7 p.m. It's American Roots.